leave, we haven't done everything we ought to do. And sometimes they're really not honest soul searching. Gee, when this person left, did we really treat this person right? Did we really care for this person? Was this person in some kind of spiritual distress and did we ignore them? Instead, no, what's wrong with that guy? You know, he was always in my life. And instead, you know, we absolve ourselves for blame and dump the blame all on him. These people that leave, they don't sometimes don't want to take any responsibility either. It's all your fault. You know, it's ISKCON's fault. And this formation, in some ways, has gotten quite pathological. But we have to understand that this can go on in both sides, the shifting of blame. But you want to avoid responsibility for what one has to have done. It says here, paranoiac types. Paranoia, you know, persecution complex. Now, what I see in this Riptic formation is this development of paranoia, because it has the classic centerpiece of paranoia, socialized paranoia, which is a conspiracy theory. You know, this is often typical of extreme right-wing political formations. The conspiracy theory of history, you know, and these conspiracy theories of history usually are, some people in this room may believe in a conspiracy theory of history. They've made their way around ISKCON, but generally, you know, they're the product of people who are not very socially well established, who cannot get ahead in society, who feel deprived, and begin to think that there's somebody who's working against me. The typical victims of people who are blamed for this conspiracy are, of course, the Jews, at least in Europe. The Jews have always been there. And, you know, there was their famous book put out in the early part of the century called The Protocols of the Learner Elders of Zion. Supposedly, at least scholars say, it was a forgery by the Tsarist police. What were they called? The Okhrana or something? I've forgotten. Somebody, the secret police under the Tsarist regime, supposedly produced this forgery, which is supposed to be a meeting of Jewish elders, how they're going to take over the world, right? So this is a general conspiracy theory that's been going around for a long time. And it's thought to have been black propaganda. People sometimes do that. With the Church of Zion, I remember once when in the early 70s, the Church of Scientology produced forged a deprogramming manual called The Constructive Deconstruction of Belief. And it was supposedly a manual by deprogrammers. And, you know, all these academics who were defending cults, you know, had this supposedly anti-cult deprogramming manual, and then all of a sudden they began to understand that it was actually forged by the Church of Scientology, you know. So that's what's supposed to have been this Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. And it was interesting, now the ISKCON conspiracy theory with the Ritvik thing holds that somehow or other, you know, Prabhupada wanted to establish this Ritvik theory, and that the GBC or some group in the GBC entered into conspiracy to foil Prabhupada's desires. Now, you know, I personally checked this out when I first heard it. I thought, okay, let me see. There's no evidence of such a thing. All the evidence points to that Prabhupada wanted the standard. You know, anybody who knew Prabhupada, when he wanted to change something, he didn't tell it to one person who then hid it, or two people who then hid it. When he wanted to make a point, I've been there. Call all the GBC in And then he would explain something from the top to the bottom, from the bottom to the top, from, you know, left to right and right to left. And do you understand six times until you could repeat it back to him? Prabhupada was very capable of giving clear instructions, believe me. And so this theory that somehow or other he indicated this to one or two people who then hit it, it just makes Prabhupada out to be too stupid, you know. But the Ritvik thing, again, it's a group of people who are disappointed in their spiritual life, who haven't made spiritual advancement, and they want somebody to blame. And so this is it's ISKCON. Spiritual masters have fallen down. This is because, you know, we didn't follow this this Ritvik system. But it's a conspiracy theory, and I was interested to see that I got this newsletter from one of the prime Ritvik guys, this fellow named Paranjana, who actually wrote a whole treatise about the number of Jews on the GBC and tying in the Ritvik conspiracy to the general overall Jewish world control conspiracy, you know. So you could see that he had been, the paranoid formations had really really carried him quite a bit further. So, but generally the idea is there's people who are actively working against me. Sometimes it's got he says, delusions of self-importance, you know, that actually, you know, I have the key to be the savior of ISKCON, and only these envious people are keeping me down. You know, otherwise, if it weren't for this conspiracy to recognize me, so there's these delusions of self-importance also. Now, I'll tell you a story about somebody I encountered which illustrates these kinds of points. This happened to me in my capacity as the GBC for Gita Nagari. So a number of years ago, Gita Nagari was in a difficult position when I got it. It had flourished under a painting business. But by the time 87 came around, the painting business was sort of collapsing of its own weight. And there was maybe at that time 150 cows there. The herd had gotten extremely large. And without the painting business, there was no way to feed these cows. And so there was a lot of difficulty there. I mean, there the previous GBC and initiating guru Satrup Maharaj, he had not fallen down or anything like that, but still the whole system, the zonal acharya system, was collapsing, and very few people. The painting businesses were just being carried on by a few people who were very angry that the money that they had sent into Gita Nagari never manifest anything it was supposed to be used for, and so on. So anyway, we had a problem there, and the problem was taking care of these cows on a very small income. And we had a program called Adopt a Cow, which basically got people to help pay for the cows. And that was a major source of income at that time. Well, it was very difficult. There was a lot of cows. There was a few workers. The people with real expertise weren't there. So there was a certain devotee. Who came to Gita Nagari. He had been in Washington D.C. temple, and he had achieved some success as a Sankirtan devotee, which means a painting salesman in this case. He's a very high energy, almost manic sort of a person. And so he had received a lot of praise, and because he collected a lot of money. And he was married, and I guess his wife couldn't have children, so they had adopted some children. And his marriage fell apart. He got involved in an adulterous relationship, and it blew the marriage for the woman. And when she could, she finally got out of it, found somebody else to protect her. She was afraid of him. He was a
very dominating person, and she found somebody else finally, and she left him. So his marriage had failed. And he had always had difficulty controlling his sexual desire. Later on, after all this stuff developed, somebody told me, oh, I was a bhakta with him. He used to have sexual fantasies about Radharani all the time. You know? I can't believe the guy ever got initiated, he said to me. Anyway, he was... he used to come to Gita Nagari and work very hard. He was a very hard-working guy. Help repair things and everything like this. So one day, we were all worried about the plight of the cows and having enough money, and the barn was falling apart. Everything was falling apart simply because there wasn't enough money. So while he was in Washington, D.C., he used to go back and forth between Washington, D.C. and Gita Nagari. It's about a three and a half hour car automobile ride. While he was there, he met in a parking lot one congregational member, an Indian fellow, a very successful physician, was a big donor to ISKCON, is now an initiated devotee. I don't think he was initiated then, but a very, very good devotee.
Is
Dr. Murray? Just don't say names, okay? If you know who it is, keep it to yourself. I want to protect myself from lawsuits and telling the story. Anyway, this devotee managed to convince the Indian physician that the cows are in a very difficult plight, and he has secured for him a very large donation. I mean, something in the order of $80,000 or something like that. A huge donation for the cows. And then he went to the temple president of Gita Nagari and said, you know, I have this donation for the cows. We have to save the cows. Actually, no one is taking care of them. So the arrangement that was made was that this devotee managed to be put in charge of the agricultural department. His thing was, he'd also convinced the donor that he was the one who cared most about the cows, that actually nobody else in Gita Nagari cared about the cows, that he was the one that was the real empowered cow carer for, and that if it weren't for him, the cows would really have really been neglected. So the upshot was, is this donation was coming, this devotee became in charge of the agricultural department and the cows. He got his salary, and he had some friends. Now these friends were former core members, but who had moved out to the edge, and were also highly critical of the temple devotees in Gita Nagari. And they were also compromised in their spiritual life. They were only following the two regulative principles. They seemed to have some affinity for marijuana and other people's wives and so on, like that. It is these people that he said either the only ones he could work with, that they really cared about the cows. And also they got hired by the agricultural department. Now, I went to the temple president and I said, are you so sure this is a good idea? He said, well, this is the only way we can get Dr. So-and-so's money, because he really, you know, has faith in this devotee. And second of all, he does work really hard, and let's give these people a chance, and I can control him. I can take care of it. So I said, all right, well, if you think that's the way to go, okay, but I think there's going to be problems. One thing was everybody, all the devotees at Gita Nagari were dirt poor. I mean, they had no money. Everybody was scratching a living somehow or other. And by Gita Nagari standards, this fellow and his friends all had fairly opulent salaries. I mean, they weren't high by Karmi standards, but by Gita Nagari standards, they were a lot of money. They started to really fix the barn, repair the fences, do this. The place really started to look better like this. But meanwhile, his hostility to the other devotees at Gita Nagari started to increase. And they also began to complain to the temple president. You know, these guys, they're taking all of this money, but they're not working so hard, you know. Actually, you know, they worked hard at first and they got things together, but now things are going on automatic pilot and we don't even see them there that much. But when the temple president would question them about it, then there'd be a big uproar and fights and hostility and stuff like that, you know. So it was a tense situation. Well, things came to a head when this devotee approached me. And we had a conversation that, he was having an affair with another woman who had been a husband of an ex-devotee or something like that, one of these people on the outside. He started cohabitating with her and having an affair with her. He wasn't chanting his rounds, and he was living with this woman. In fact, I knew very well. In fact, and I told this doctor, you know, I guarantee you she's going to get pregnant. I said, the devotee, she's not going to use birth control. And sure enough, she did get pregnant. But so this way he was compromised and being, of course, criticized by the temple devotees. But he was becoming increasingly arrogant and puffed up all during this time. Having this affair, then he came to me. I guess he had gone to the temple president. The temple president referred to me. Now he was already in charge of the agriculture department. Now he wanted to take over Adopt-A-Cow, the fundraising with mail outs and letters and going to places and raising funds. And the major income was coming in from fundraising. So I was frank with him. I said, you know, I understand that you aren't strictly following the principles of Krishna consciousness. And I said, but, you know, I still think that that's okay that you're in charge of the agriculture department and you can take care of the cows and that you're doing a good job and I'm happy with you. I said to him, but I think that the Adopt-A-Cow program is actually our major preaching program. And it's our requirement that if you want to be in charge of a major preaching program, actually you have to be a strict devotee. You have to chant your rounds and you have to follow the four regular principles. You know, why don't you try to get it together, and then when you do, we'll consider your proposal. You know. Well, this was unacceptable to him. He didn't like this. And so he began to argue with me, and he began to argue that for him, the fact that he was so dedicated to taking care of the cows, the fact that he wasn't strictly following, didn't really matter so much. So I said to him that, you know, actually it's very important. We are following the principles laid down by Srila Prabhupada. Actually, even for doing what you're doing now, you should be strictly following, but we'll let you do this. And he said, you know, all these devotees who are strictly following, they're not taking care of the cows. They've let everything go to hell. They weren't able to get this donation. But somehow or other, Krishna has empowered me to get this donation and to get, you know, a hold of this, take care of the cows. And so here we see this, you know, self-assertion build up. And then he actually, after he went on his whole thing about what he was able to do that nobody else was able to do, he said to me, "You don't know who I am." Then I made a terrible mistake. You see, at that point, I should have realized what I was dealing with and said, well, I'm sorry, so long, you know, too bad. You know what I said to him? It was really stupid. I said to him, he said, when he said, "You don't know who I am," I said, I got angry. And I said, "I know you better than you know yourself." Because, of course, I could see exactly what he was doing. By this, I had already been studying poison and things like that. You know, And I said to him, I know you better than you know yourself. I basically announced, I see through his game. So he flipped. You know, he stormed out in a rage and like that. So I just wasn't, you know, going to validate his substitution of this for the real thing. So what happened is, meanwhile, there were other rumors that he's going to take over. His self-importance was inflating. He was actually going to take over Gita Nagari. He was actually going to become the GBC for the place and so on like that. And his blaspheming of the devotees began to increase. He began to get in actual fist fights with a few devotees and the property. Mother Kalini, a senior lady there, he started screaming at her and cursing her and things like that. I mean, it was really, like, really full of rage and things like that. So there was a rebellion of the grassroots devotees, finally. And meanwhile, the temple president is still trying to keep him, pacify everybody, but it was getting a little difficult. You want to ask a question?
I just want to know what year this was.
So, Dhamma, do you know what year this was?
It started in, I think it was 92.
Yeah, it was like 92, 93.
92, 93, yeah. Yeah, so then... No, it was a little later than that. Then what happened, that year at the Gita Nagari Ratha Yatra, this doctor came to the Ratha Yatra. And about a dozen devotees said, we want to meet with Dr. So-and-so. We got to talk about this devotee. This has just gone too far. I mean, there was really a grassroots rebellion. And so we had a meeting at which these devotees, one after another, told horror stories to this doctor. And the temple president said, basically, the temple president said to the doctor, you know, well, I'm keeping him here because, you know, you want him here. And the doctor says, I don't want, you know, he immediately, they didn't want all the devotees mad at him. So the upshot is that the devotee who was in charge of the Cal department lost his position. Now, he was given what's called a golden parachute. He got a couple of, you know, month's salary, severance pay. He got to keep the truck. I mean, it was a deal like you never get anywhere in ISKCON. It was a super generous kind of a thing. But he had basically lost his position. So he responded by simply upping the stakes of his delusion. As the savior of the Cal. Now he went on a crusade. Unfortunately, what happened is the other people who were working with him, you know, they all backed out also. They wouldn't have anything to do with the temple anymore because of what had happened. And so the next person that we had, the only person had to take care of the cows, was not really very competent, and he made mistakes. But this time, the dismissed devotee was going around, sneaking around, taking pictures. You know, you have old sick cows. You know, you ever take pictures of old sick cows? And then there was a horrible incident where this cow got loose from the barn at night, went up to the top floor of the barn, fell through the floor, got electrocuted. So there was this cow hanging there. But these kinds of things have happened before. I mean, but they said because the other devotee wasn't taking care of them, and so they were taking pictures and things like that. So the dismissed devotee went on a campaign with the local newspapers with an expose of abuse of cows at the Krishna farm. And the local newspapers didn't know what they were dealing with, so they printed all this stuff. You know, he had these pictures of this cow and this whole thing. He went to the local newspapers. So we went to the local newspapers, and we got a vet, and the vet came and examined the cows and said there's nothing wrong with them. There are, in fact, some old and sick cows, but we're not used to seeing them because we all kill them, you know, when they're 5 years old. So he went on this campaign with the local newspapers. He called all the animal rights organizations. He got a hold of the Adopt-a-Cow mailing list. He was actually a former member of the Church of Scientology, it turned out, where he had learned many of these techniques of of dealing with an opposition in this way. And then, of course, he got socialized because somehow or other he got in contact with the Ritvik people and this guy Paranjana. And they said, "You're right, it's all the gurus, it's ISKCON, you know." And of course, they're looking for crazy people to turn into assassins. So he was now he had social reinforcement and support. And so this really fired him up. He went on a letter writing, and always with maniacal energy. You know, he would write reams and reams of letters. I saw a letter he wrote to the Attorney General of the United States, you know, telling them that I'm a cult leader and another David Koresh and all this other kind of stuff. Writing to newspapers, media. Now he thinks he's important, you see. I mean, if you're the Attorney General of the United States or a big person and you get a letter of ranting and raving, 50 pages long, you don't read it. With lots of capital words and stuff like that. You know, you recognize the product of somebody that's crazy. But anyway, he was going on. Oh, then of course he turned against Satsrup Maharaj, his nominal spiritual master. That was the next thing. He was now accustomed to whenever there was a festival of Gita Nagari we had to get a restraining order to keep him off the property. So he would stand outside the property with a van plastered with signs and anti-guru posters. And then for Satsrup's Vyasa Puja, he had a whole pile of Satsrup Maharaj's books which he was going to burn. You know, this is what happened to him. When he turned on Satsrup Maharaj, in one way it was a little better for me because a lot of people were suspecting that maybe he was right about me. But when he turned on Satsrup Maharaj, then everybody could understand, you know, where he was coming from. So, I mean, this is the way he went. He went on, Satsrup Maharaj said, "Kindly, I don't want any controversy on the day my disciples are observing Vyasa Puja." So the next day he came to the temple and he screamed at Satsrup Maharaj, and who walked out. And then phone calls all the time, obsessive phone calls. Again, calling, pretending to be somebody else. Forged letters. He sent out a letter where I recanted the reform movement, you know, and endorsed the Ritvik thing, which was forged with my name, you know, a forged letter to everybody. People actually called me up. "Hey, you really embrace the Ritvik position?" It's a completely illiterate letter. My feelings are so hurt. How do you think I could write a letter like that? Also forged letters under Satsrup Maharaj's signature, you know. It's still going on. I mean, it hasn't ended. In some way, the last couple of Ratyatras, he's there with signs. You know, the New York Ratyatra and the Washington Ratyatra, he was there with signs, which is got so much writing on it you can't read it, and crazy little things, you know. So right away you recognize, you know, the style of craziness, you know, right off the bat. But that's an example now of what can happen, where you really get a kind of degeneration into paranoia and mania and conspiracy theories and things like that. So his whole thing was like, here's a person who, like, as far as his actual spiritual life had gone, he had crashed. He had really crashed in a big way, and was a failure by the objective standards of ISKCON. But now what he had done was he was created this concealment device in which he was actually the savior of ISKCON. Nobody else could save ISKCON. A lot of his wrath was directed toward Brahmins, right? The Brahmins couldn't do it, but he was actually the empowered savior of ISKCON. And he was unable to do his job because envious people were conspiring against him to protect their position. And the most amazing thing was that he actually had a group of people that were giving him social reinforcement and support and actually egging him on in this craziness. So there's an example of the sorts of things that can that can happen. So I'm telling this story in the interest of clinical illustration of these points that Boysen is making. And I think many people in their experience, if you've had any experience in ISKCON, you'll run into these kinds of formations here and there and everywhere. And the lesson I learned from this, if you see that a person's at a certain point, and we'll talk about this, and Boysen, he says sometimes he has to pass judgment. Is this person somebody I can help? Or is it somebody whose, defenses and concealment devices are so powerful that there's really nothing I can do for them? And with this devotee, if there had been some attitude of accepting me or somebody as an authority, some attitude of willing to accept some judgment from somewhere or advice from somebody, but the hostility, the suspicion, the jealousy was so big, that there was nothing I could say that would have helped him, and it would have been better for me if I just not even tried to tell him anything. Then we unloosed another, crazy person on the rest of the movement, unfortunately. Any questions about that one? Comments? Observations? Now this is a... So a lot of times you'll discover that people, he's acting this way, and we say it's conflicting. And one way, he's not conscious of what he's doing, but on another level he sort of obscurely is conscious. He's at least still got some idea of the goal. If he completely had forgotten the ideals of Krishna consciousness, he would have just gone away. But he couldn't forget. And so now he had to insist upon, that somehow or other people have to recognize me as a great devotee, even though I'm not actually, in my own eyes, deep inside, he knows he's doing what he shouldn't be doing. Yeah?
It seems like if he just expended some of that energy toward being a strict devotee, he could have made
it. Yeah, of course.
Leaps and bounds, yeah. Spiritual advancement.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah.
Uh-huh. I knew this person, and before he was living in the Potomac Temple for quite a while, and I was there. And he became quite ravenous in his attacks, or rabid, I should say. Mm-hmm. And then he moved outside.
His attacks?
Attacks on the temple management.
On the temple management when he was there.
Yeah, I was a secretary leader, of course, mm-hmm. It's delish. And then he went outside. His wife disavowed her relationship with her spiritual master, and also just was very, very critical of ISKCON. And for a while, I didn't see much of him. Mm-hmm. And then I was there at a festival when he came back to Itanagari after his wife had run off, and he was very humble, and it was almost like he was going through a whole reorganization. Mm-hmm. He was just devastated by the whole experience, and was quite humble for a period of time. And then the same type of behavioral patterns that he had, that he was developed before moving outside, came on much stronger. Mm-hmm. So it's a reorganization. Mm-hmm.
Something failed. Failed. Huh?
Yeah.
So, Donna?
I can sort of understand that how the process of concealment, how it ended up, in such a paranoid way. But what's the motivation or the reaction mode or solution or whatever for people who are, in other words, people like that, they often end up having some group of people that actually believe in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Are they just other people that are looking for a leader in concealment?
Yeah, well, in this particular case, you see, the people that supported him were people who had the same kind of thing. There were these Ritvik people who again were shifting the blame for their own spiritual shortcomings onto somebody else.
They were kind of using him.
Well, they were using him.
People underneath him that just kind of, he did have some.
But it was a very weak sort of a socialization,
yeah.
when it really came down to him, they said, oh, he's too, you know, he was really more of an isolated type. I mean, the social reinforcement was the Ritvik people were using him, and those other people that were with him, they eventually kept their distance from him. And they said, you know, he's too crazy even for us. He's too much. And they agreed with his criticisms, although they didn't agree with some of his methods. But when he went after Satsarup Maharaj, it came almost too much for everybody. Locally, you know.
What happened to him when you said that you know him better than he knows? What was the relationship between you and him?
At that point, he jumped up and yelled something. And
but what happened in his mind?
What happened in his mind? What happened in his mind was, I guess, he saw me as just like laying down some heavy-duty condemnation of him. And it was clear that I wasn't going to accept his own evaluation of himself. You don't know who I am, he said.
You confronted him, basically.
Yeah, I confronted him, and I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah,
of course, then I became a big, big demon out to stop him from fulfilling Krishna's desire.
Unless he would have accepted you as a...
Yeah, but he didn't. There was not even an ounce of that possible.
So therefore,
and I was stupid not to recognize that, I think.
But what your wife said brought up a question they had about yesterday's class. Is it okay to...
Mm-hmm.
It's all... concealment of bluffing, and you know, in the manifestation that you presented yesterday, that became almost society-wide in your movement. So, you know, I could, in my own self-analysis, I could see how I had a sense of failure, and this was a way that I could conceal it and have this manifestation of self-importance and what have you. But I'm just wondering, I have a difficulty applying that to a lot of the whole society. It seems that, you know, maybe in that, I'm just wondering if you could defend that position.
You mean how it could apply to the whole society?
Yeah.
Well, it did.
This paradigm of
let me say how sometimes these things get socialized, like bluffing. Prabhupada talks about the cheater and the cheated. And that seems to me exactly what he's talking about there. Why do people accept a cheater guru? Because they're cheating themselves. And when they asked this big con man, who, Willie Sutton or somebody, he was a bank robber, there was some big con man, they asked him if he felt bad about tricking so many people with the confidence game. And he said, I never conned an honest person. So the cheater and the cheated. I mean, Prabhupada said when people have gotten cheated, a lot of times they want to be cheated in a sense because they want... Well, of course, Prabhupada's talking about people who accept, you know, some guru who says, you know, you chant this mantra for 6 months and you'll become God. He's a cheater. Who buys for it? Somebody says, oh, I can just do a simple thing and then I become God. You know, so they get cheated, but they're asking for it. You know, I remember in the Philadelphia airport, there were guys who used to sell these cheap watches. They have them all on their arms. And they made you think they were Rolexes. If you look closely, it said Bolex or something, you know. But they sold these really cheap watches that had expensive names put on them. And they were going to give you a very expensive watch for only a few dollars. Now, why would you think that you could get a very expensive watch for a few dollars? Because they hinted to you that actually these were stolen watches that they were selling. So basically everybody who did it thought was a cheater because he was thinking he was buying stolen goods and therefore he's getting something valuable cheap. And they got home and the watch broke after 2 days, you know, because it was just junk. And they found out they got cheated. So there's all there's sometimes a complicity, an unconscious getting together of people like that. Sometimes people really get cheated. I mean, that does have to happen. But in this case, when things get socialized sometimes, people will do that. So I had noticed during the worst days of the Zonal Acharya system, when one particular Zonal Acharya had fallen into pretty gross sense gratification. And he had collectors and leaders who were giving him a lot of money. And he was spending it, right? He was going scuba diving and, you know, living it up and so many things, and engaged in what was obvious to any outsider is a sense gratification. He's a certain special kind of person. You can't understand his lila and stuff like that. This is Bhavananda in Australia. But it turned out that the main people that were also giving him money and supporting him, they were also getting a big cut, and they were also engaged in sense gratification. So basically, there was a deal: you protect my sense gratification, and I'll protect your sense gratification. But all of them were thinking, we're really pushing on the Krishna consciousness movement. At the same time, they were sincerely convinced, because their criterion now for success was basically, all this money is going to Mayapur. And the people in Mayapur were saying to them, boy, you are great devotees. Look at all the money you're giving to Mayapur. So everybody was getting what they thought was the effects of Krishna consciousness without having to go through the bother of the Krishna consciousness. You know, so they were involved in a kind of unconscious deal with each other. Yeah.
It's called being like neurotically compatible. It's like the sadist and the masochist.
Yeah, that's.
It's these masochists and masochists.
Yeah, so sometimes people are attracted to each other on these principles. You know. So sometimes you can see it. I remember we had a girl in our temple who wanted to get initiated at that time by Hamsadutta. And at that time, although Hamsadutta was still an official initiating ISKCON guru, enough things were happening that I was a little apprehensive. So I said to her a few things, trying to kind of steer her away without being too obvious. And she got all, "You're blaspheming my guru," she said, you know. But then she said the real reason she was attracted to him was that he let you wear, girls wear blue jeans and chew gum. So I thought that she's getting the guru she deserved. You know, I mean, that's why she's attracted to this person, because of some lower standard. You know, so somehow or other, people were being gravitating to each other. This doesn't happen in every case, but it happens a lot, often enough. So there's that one, the cheater and the cheated. That people actually, in a way, want to be cheated. They're asking for it. And so those people are provided for them to do like that. So we can see this happens. So all we can do to guard against is to make sure we ourselves are honest.
You feel in this type of situation where one's cheated because he wants, you know, he's a cheater. In this whole example of Sankirtan that you gave yesterday, that the same progression of a sense of personal failure, mm-hmm. and then not being able to socialize it, mm-hmm. and you know, that one becomes one sense that almost was socialized, though, wasn't it? I mean, everybody, there was a lot of camaraderie.
Yeah, in sure. It.
But this fits this whole progression of the psychology.
I think what was going on in those days was, in one sense, there was a lot of camaraderie, and But in a deeper, real sense, there was also a lot of isolation, because devotees felt themselves, I mean, on the real issues of their spiritual life, a lot of times they couldn't talk to each other. If you look at that thing I handed out about this, one of the things I handed out to you, oh, I have it here.